You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
And I remember just being like, this is insane. I can't believe people actually want to watch me do this. This is so cool. And the reason why I want to do that was Trivium has never been, I mean, up until this 10th record, we've never really been like press band or a band that's like heralded by anything other than our fans and our supporters. So I want to give back to them. I want to be like, I want to hang out with the people that are liking my breakfast photos from the Midwest of America. And I want to play video games with them and just hang out.
Hey, what's up, Vox and Hops heads? I'm Matt, the vocalist of Cryptopsy and the host of the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast, brought to you by Sound Talent Media and Evergreen Podcasts, where I sit down with fellow metal musicians to talk about their lives, music, and craft beer. I hope you had a glorious weekend. I most certainly did, because I was at Kanawaki Brewing, where there was a brand new Vox and Hops collab that dropped. That's right, 3 collabs, 3 weeks. This one was a special one. It's called Monstrosity, and it's actually kind of a competition brew. There are 2 versions of Monstrosity, where Drew Stevens, the head brewer of Kanawaki Brewing, has created 2 teams of Quebec craft beer media people, and the teams had to decide what crazy things were going to go into this beer, just the most weird adjuncts that we could think of, hence the name Monstrosity. I gotta tell you that I think that my team, the Youngbloods, brew was absolutely the best, but the other beer was also really good, Monstralicious. The Youngbloods brew was a smoothie sour that contained mango, peaches, vegan marshmallows, cinnamon, and carrots, and it was absolutely to die for. You can only pick it up at K-Town Brewing. They do not distribute, but it's definitely worth the trip out there if you can do that. This Vox and Hops episode is presented by Heavy Montreal. Heavy Montreal are Montreal's premier metal promoter, and I'm very stoked to announce that the second edition of Heavy Montreal Presents Vox and Hops Brutal Montreal will be taking place at Corona Theater on September 2nd. Performing at this year's event is Deicide, who will be playing their classic album Legion in its entirety, with support from Cataclysm, who will be playing Serenity in Fire, their classic album. And opening up the show, we got Inhuman Condition. This is going to be a massive event. Tickets are now on sale, and you should absolutely go pick up your ticket if you want to come, because it's going to sell out via the link in the description of this podcast. I'm beyond stoked to have Heavy Montreal behind the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast. They are the best. Now, before we jump into today's episode, I'd just like to ask you to follow the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast on the podcast platform of your choice. But more than that, I'm asking you to rate and write a review for the podcast. Now, why do I want you to do that? Well, you have to imagine that when someone is looking for a brand new podcast to listen to, what do? They scroll down, they check out the comments, they check out those reviews, and if the comments and the reviews are favorable, they're most probably going to give that podcast a chance. So by you rating the podcast, and even better, by writing a review, you could actually be the person that helps sway someone's decision to become a brand new Vox and Hops head, and that would be something that I would truly appreciate. Now today on the podcast, I'm with Matt Heafy of Trivium and Ibaraki. Get ready, everyone. This is Vox and Hops episode number 334.
I warn you, what you are about to hear is very disturbing indeed.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Today I'm with Matt Heafy of Trivium. Matt, how you doing? Let's start with an easy, simple question.
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good, good. It's cold. It's, you know, Montreal. We're getting slammed with snow. But
what's my weather here?
Being from Montreal,
let me let you know what we're at. We are 73 degrees Fahrenheit right now. Oof. Which is perfect.
It's not so bad.
It's perfect.
This week's a little better than last
week. Yeah, I bet it's
at,
like, what, negative
30.
Yeah, I can imagine. That's why I live in Florida, where I don't have to ever deal with cold weather. It was like 60 yesterday, and people were dressed like it was the Arctic tundra here. Like, I saw people walking down my street just dressed in complete, like they were snowmen.
I love it. Let's just jump into the meat of things. I like to start this off shittily so we can go somewhere else a little bit better afterwards. How did you cope with the glorious year of 2020, 2021, and hopefully not 2022? How have you been coping with your time in these crazy times of the pandemic?
It's been great. It's essentially been business as usual for me. I've been streaming on Twitch for 4.5 years now, about that. And right when the world shut, finally all the people had been telling, hey, come look at my channel, come look at my channel, come look at my channel. They were all home. So they're finally like, I'm going to look at what Matt's been talking for the last 2.5 years. They all tuned in. I had my regular schedule going, regular scheduled programming, and it was fantastic to be able to connect everyone. The only thing we weren't able to do, obviously, was play shows for some of that time. But America is pretty YOLO. So like America was like, all right, let's go. So we just finished our first tour in like a year and a half. That metal tour of the year, which was incredible. It was like 5,000 to 10,000 people a night. We just announced leg two. That'll probably be 5,000 to 10,000 people a night as well. So the ticket sales are going nuts on that. So yes, I don't want to make it sound like I had too much of a good time when I know a lot of people didn't have a good time, but I made sure that I had the channel there so people could be there, have a community, have people they can talk to daily. I talked to a lot of people from the channel that all said, I don't know where I'd be, like if I'd be in a here physically or not, if we didn't have the channel available, because like those are the people I look forward to seeing every single day, talking to those people every single day. So it was amazing to have that. It was great that I was able to provide that for people.
It's amazing and incredible that you've built something. So it's massive. It's if you talk to anyone about any musicians on Twitch, you're at the
Thank
top.
Thank you. Appreciate so. That. I appreciate it. It's all thanks to the supporters. It's all thanks to them. It's not me.
Highly impressive. I'm impressed.
Thank you.
Vox and Hops is all about hanging out with my metal friends, talking about their lives, music, and craft beer. Now, you won't be drinking with me just right now. Maybe you can tell me why. But what will you be drinking, and what are you going to be sipping on throughout this conversation?
Yeah, I'm not, because I've got twin 3-year-olds, and basically as soon as I'm off the clock in this room, I run out there, and it's time to take care of them. So we play hot potato during the day, my wife and I, because we both work from home. And they're three, and 3-year-olds are nuts, and twins are nuts. So that's why. But yes, I love beer so much. I love it. I've been through all the different phases of beer. A phase that I recently kind of fell out of, that I still love them, is the fruited smoothie sour beers. That's something I was obsessed with for a long time. You got one? Nice.
I do.
Yeah, so I actually had to get like a special app and everything to order them, because where did I have my first one? Corey one day brought over. He's like, yeah, someone sent me this care package for my birthday, a beer. He's like, I don't drink beer, so here you go. Hand it to me. And it was the Energy City. It was the mango banana, I believe. And I'd never had anything like that in my life. It was like having a fruit smoothie that had alcohol content. So I was like, this is amazing. I started calling all the places around town. No one had them. Like, no one had the smoothie beers. I was like a little too early to find those. So I got the same app and ordered tons of them. And yeah, now my fridge is overstocked with fruited smoothie beers. Then I started getting the milkshake IPAs. But right now, since becoming a dad, and I think it kind of rubbed off from Paulo getting me into this, I've really been into Pilsners pretty much exclusively lately. Anything like European summer beer, Helles, Kolsch, Pilsner, alt beer. And since I brought off Kolsch and alt beer at the same time, the rivalry, I will settle it with, they're pretty similar, but the color is darker than the alt beer. I'd rather drink more Kolsch than more alt beer. Alt beer. Holy cow, that's hard to say as a Japanese person. Alt beer. There it is.
But you're right on trend, because a lot of people get into craft beer through the smoothies, through the hazy IPAs, and then as their palate develops, they end up just settling right back into the crispy boys.
Yep, yep.
Something you can drink, like, you know, many more of them without, you know, feeling super bloated and
exactly.
Disgusting afterwards. The ABVs tend to be lower.
When I first got a craft beer, it was IPAs first, as it, I feel like it always is. You either, like you said, you stick there, you go to the different range. I went from there to German Hefeweizen, which is still one of my favorites of all time. And then heavily into Belgians, but like the really brutal Belgians, like quads, apt, triples. But you can drink more than one of those. But if you do drink more than one of those, you're kind of wrecked. So it's settling into the hell. Would it be Helli? No, it wouldn't. Helles. Helles is, yeah, that's the Latin joke, I think. Helli.
Okay.
I found one of my favorite breweries in America recently called Urban Chestnut. Now what they do is they actually stick to the, I don't know if it's the exact German purity laws or rules that how intense Germany does it, but they do the stuff like very legitimately German tasting. So their Hefeweizen is the only Hefeweizen I've had outside of Germany that tastes like a German Hefeweizen. Because a lot of the imported Hefeweizens, I feel like they kind of lose it a little bit, and they kind of lose the plot of what Hefeweizen should taste like. But Urban Chestnuts, I can't remember the name. I'm having serious dad brain for all names today, but Urban Chestnuts Hefeweizen. Schnickelfritz is some of the greatest Hefeweizen I've ever had before.
Fantastic. I'm going to crack this open. This is Brew Juice, which is from Brewski, which is here in Montreal. They make the best fruited sours,
yes,
in Quebec. They were one of the first, and their brewer, Derek, is an absolute wizard. I love him to death. Last year we dropped Brutal Juice, which was a Vox and Hops collab, but this is not that. This has chocolate, raspberries, blueberries, and marshmallows in it. 5.2%. It's on the thick side of it, as I said. I'm going to crack this, pour this out, and I'd love to hear about your very first beer. Do you remember the first beer you drank, Matt?
Yes. Our original drummer, Travis, took me to a house party when I was still in eighth grade. So I was like 12 or 13. Dang, that looks good. 12 or 13. And I mean, the area that we all grew up in Florida is like pretty southern and it's pretty Florida. So we went to like one of those like very Florida looking parties and everyone's drinking Natty Light. Was it Natty? Yeah, I think it was Natty Light.
Natty Light.
Yeah, so that was the first time I remember having half of it, threatening to fight him. First, the first thing I said, like, where are all the chicks at? And then I started threatening to fight Travis. And I was like 12 and a half, 13 years old. So 12 and a half, 13 year old should not be drinking beer.
No.
12 and a half to 13 to 14-ish. I think that the European standard is pretty good. 16 for your first beer at your house with your folks. You're not driving. You're not going anywhere. You know, 18, 21 for maybe 18 for wine, 21 for maybe hard stuff. I guess that's probably a good scaling reference. But yeah, that was pretty Florida. So Natty Ice, half of it, threatened to fight my bandmate. the next one I think would have been a Smirnoff Ice. A month, like 6 months to 12 months later, which is not beer.
No.
The next would be, I think I had a six pack of Heineken and I remember just feeling like, I don't think I puked, but just feeling terrible. And then my mom saw me like smiling and giggling in her kitchen because I was still at my parents' house. And so she heated up, it was either chicken cacciatore or chicken adobo at like 2 a.m. to feed me that in the night so I wouldn't feel as bad the next day. So I remember those three stories pretty... The Smirnoff story I don't remember vividly, but the other two I remember.
That's a good bomb.
Yes, cheers.
Cheers to you. This is the chocolate really pops in your mouth right away there.
That is awesome. I that sounds right up my alley.
You can smell it too.
The first time I ever had a...
Sour, tart.
It's awesome.
Really nice.
First ever had a fruited smoothie beer, I think was at Delirium Bar in Brussels. And it was the Mongozo Coconut. I had it with Austin from As Lions, and that thing changed my life. So I had that years back, and then it wasn't until Corey brought over that Energy City. When I first had that Energy City, I actually DM'd them immediately. I was like, hey, I want to buy as many cases as I can. What do I do? Like, we can't even ship to you. And they basically just sell their stuff out of like a drive-through lot that weekend and always sells out. I'd say that they make the best fruited smoothie beers I've ever had. The milkshake IPAs are pretty good. The milkshake IPAs are good. I like everything. As long as it's good, I'll try it. My friend, he collects kind of older, like the Bourbon County stuff. So like the mm-hmm. really strong stouts, he collects those and he'll give me like, I just drank a 2017 the other day. I think those mm-hmm. are like 8.5 to 9%, but I do love those as well. So when it's cold in Florida, I drink those. Now, I never have to tell you, your band, Cryptopsy, massive influence on me. Massive. The song.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, the Whisper Supremacy record, Cold Hate Warm Blood, actually influenced the riffs of my hatred. So, like, there's that connection from that intro and the verse of Cold Hate Warm Blood. And I know you popped in around, like, 2008, 2009 is when you got in, right? Yep. Love your band, man. Absolutely love your band.
Thank you. I've been following you since the beginning as well, since Ascendancy.
Man, thanks, man.
And I've only actually seen you live once, I believe. I think you came through Club Soda with Dillinger Escape Plan.
Was that in Toronto or Montreal?
Montreal.
I can't remember if it happened in Montreal or in Toronto, but that tour was one of the roughest tours we've ever done in our entire lives because the lineup was Dillinger Escape Plan at their prime, The End, Red Yellow, and Trivium, first of four for this very techie lineup. I remember the first show in Canada went and played. I don't think this is the Montreal one, but the whole crowd didn't stand on the floor and they all turned their back to us. I remember when we played, it wasn't Club Soda. It was the Toronto gig. We played there and like, it was just a mess of like loading our stuff in or out. And like the staff was yelling at us, promoters yelling at us. And I remember the promoter of that night, she told us that she would ruin our career in Canada and we'd never have a career in Canada and we would never do well there because of our attitudes. But I remember their stagehand threw Travis's kick drum and we got in like an argument, I think with like Dillinger's guitar tech or something. And it was a mess. Oh, it was a mess. It was like our third tour ever, but that tour was rough. I remember sleeping in the Chevy conversion van with the heat on in like Walmart, it wouldn't be Walmart, like Flying J parking lots and Tim Hortons parking lots. That was a hell of a tour.
Jeez, I missed the end. I missed the end very much.
Very good band.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's dance into the soundtrack of your youth. When you're growing up in your parents' or guardians' house, what music was playing when you were not in control of the radio? What music did your parents or guardians listen to?
Okay, it was always good stuff. It was in my dad's car. It was always Van Halen, Boston, And then once we got into metal, Black Album, Machine Head's The Burning Red. Burning Red was like a record that was always in there because Machine Head was the first live metal band I ever saw. And it was actually on the Burning Red record. And that's still my favorite Machine Head album. And I'll still tell Rob every single time, like, dude, that is my favorite record. And I think they've been embracing playing more stuff off that lately, which is really great. So it wasn't bad.
Because they pushed it away for a long time.
Yeah, they did. So it wasn't bad.
Sick. What about your first live music experience? Was it Machine Head?
No.
Did you see like something else?
Totally different. I think my first show was either Blink-182 or Less Than Jake. And growing up in Central Florida at that period of time, it's like all pop punk. And still a lot of like kind of like pop punk derivative bands come from here. Like metal's not really a thing in Central Florida. And the death metal scene people always glorify. That was in the early 90s. I was like,
yeah, exactly,
7, 6 years old. So I didn't even know what death metal was at that time. But I got into pop punk first, and it was either, like I said, Blink-182 or Less Than Jake. Those are right around the same time. Those would have been one of the first shows. I picked up guitar around 11, tried out for a pop punk band, tried out with Damn It by Blink-182. They didn't let me in the band. I gave up on guitar, gave up on being in a band, and then someone let me the Black Album. And I got into metal. After getting into metal, I was like, oh, wow, there's heavier stuff. So I started digging in and finding the first three things I heard was one song of melodic death metal is Jotun by In Flames. It was Cannibal Corpse. I can't remember which Cannibal song, and it was Cradle of Filth, Dusk and Her Embrace record. I don't remember which track. Those were the first three pieces I heard, and I was like, well, this is amazing. I started digging into each of those and going further and further in.
Amazing. How about your first time on stage? Do you remember your first show?
That would have been seventh grade talent show. It was kind of right when I was just in the metal, getting out of pop punk, playing Self-Esteem by The Offspring with a drummer named Chris in seventh grade, and we called ourselves The Vertigo. I think I was wearing like a big... You know, in the 2000, everyone wore like the button-up shirts, but it had like a visual effect. It was like black and white stripes. It was kind of like suede-y material, and it was shiny, and maybe a ball chain necklace. And then the next year, I played No Leaf Clover by Metallica and was asked to try out for a high school band called Trivium by the high school band kids who were in Trivium. And I think then, I don't remember what I was wearing, but then the next show I played was the Lake Brantley High School Battle of the Bands. And we open up with Sick by Slipknot, played For Whom the Bell Tolls by Metallica, and one or two originals.
Wow, that first show, were you ready? Were you prepped?
That one, I think I was, because when I was into pop punk, I mean, it was kind of the pop punk ethic. Like, none of them really practiced or were that great at their instruments, so I wasn't very good. So it was like true to the genre, but when I got into metal to emulate the sounds I was hearing coming from the Black Album, I had to sit in my room and play a lot. And practice a lot. So when you put a lot of that woodshed time in, I feel like it makes you a little bit more prepared for things. I'm sure the first show, the adrenaline dump is still something that these days, you know, you take a ton of time off tour, that's not something you can ever prepare for. Like five days a week, at least 2 hours a day, I'm making sure I'm rehearsed singing, screaming, guitar playing, but you can never train for adrenaline dump until you're actually playing a show. So it's always that first couple and you have to wean it down and get control of it again.
Absolutely. It's insane. I just did a Cryptopsy. We just played a show. It was Heavy Montreal Presents Vox and Hops Brutal Montreal, my festival, Metal and Beer Fest that just happened. And I was so busy conducting interviews backstage right up until the point I stepped on stage that I was halfway through Crown of Horns. And I was like, oh, shit, I'm playing a show. I got to fucking relax here and focus on what the hell I'm doing here. Because I came in like a bar and a half early, and once I start, I don't stop. You know, I'm going to finish my pattern. It's when my brain works. But thank God Chris Donaldson, my guitarist, had in-ears in for the first time, and he had no vocals in his in-ears because he would have been giving me the dirtiest looks.
Dude, I don't know how you do interviews all day into a set. That's intense. That's intense.
It just worked. I don't know. I felt, honestly, I'm typically nervous before big shows like something like that, something that I've built. But I wasn't, and my wife said the same thing, the producer of the podcast. She was like, you were just so calm and natural. I don't know. I've been looking forward to it, and it was awesome.
That's awesome. That's great.
Let's Dance on Twitch. As of today, 236,000 people follow you. It's crazy. You started before the pandemic, you mentioned. What really got you into Twitch? It really started the popularity of it from video game people. People playing video games and watching people play video games and sharing with people. How did you realize that you could use this as a weapon, basically, for music?
We had just finished a show in Barcelona. That would be about 4.5 years ago. And the promoter afterwards was like, hey, there's some YouTubers that want to meet you. And we're kind of like, huh, everyone's on YouTube. But we looked them up and we're like, all right, this main guy's got 6 million subs. This other guy's got 2 million subs. And we're like, they're all here? They're like, yeah, they're big trivia fans too. So we met them all. Really great guys. We're still good pals with them. They left the room. And after they left the room, I said it out loud in the dressing room. I was like, I should start making videos on YouTube. And Paulo actually said, he's like, I think you should look up Twitch instead. So I looked it up. I was like, oh, it's live streaming video games. Like, that's kind of right up my alley. I've been playing video games my entire life since I was about 4 or 5. I think I beat Mario 1 when I was 4 or 5, and I've just been hooked ever since. Yeah. And I started 2 accounts that night off my phone. I opened up a YouTube account and a Twitch account. I didn't really have a chance to do either till I got home. So I got home, started streaming Fallout 4, I think, was my first game I started streaming off a PS4 with a webcam with like 2 to 4 people watching me. I think all 4 of them are still subscribers to the channel.
I love
that. And I remember just being like, this is insane. I can't believe people actually want to watch me do this. This is so cool. And the reason why I want to do that was Trivium has never been, I mean, up until this 10th record, we've never really been like press band or a band that's like heralded by anything other than our fans and our supporters. So I want to give back to them. I want to be like, I want to hang out with the people that are liking my breakfast photos from the Midwest of America. And I want to play video games with them and just hang out. So that's why I started that. So I started growing meagerly, you know, like 10, 15 people. I was stoked. I was like, I can't believe people don't watch me do this. And it was never a plan to do this for any financial gain. It was just, I wanted to give back to the supporters again. And I'd go on tour, stop it, go back on. But before one of the tours, I received a tweet from someone who worked at Twitch. His name is Volition Brandon. He's still a very close friend of mine. He invited me to tour Twitch HQ. So I went down there, met Brandon and John, 2 people from Twitch. And they gave me a tour of the facilities, which were incredible. I started getting more and more into all the streamers and everything, started getting into the Twitch culture. And John and Brandon lent me this thing called the Gunrun IRL backpack. Gunrun was one of the original employees of Twitch. But it's a backpack where you can stream whatever you're doing, wherever you are. So we streamed the San Francisco.
Holy shit, that's awesome.
Yeah, streamed the San Francisco show that night. I was like, this is incredible. Like, the supporters loved it. I loved it. John and Brandon loved it. Twitch staff was there. They thought it was cool. They let me borrow it for the rest of the tour. Actually, I think I borrowed it for like a year. And so that's how I finished that up. But when I get home, I kind of went back to video games again. Became, like I said, good friends with John and Brandon, who became mentors for me. Brandon taught me about like where to start my retirement fund. And John taught me about like stocks. And they both taught me about Twitch and all these different things. So they were pals, but also mentors in Twitch and so much more. And we'd visit them in San Francisco anytime my wife and I would get tattooed. We used to fly all the way to San Francisco to get tattooed because I didn't have a tattoo artist down here. And now I finally do, thankfully. So we'd fly down over there. And I remember saying to Brandon, while we were all hanging out together, I was like, I love Twitch so much, but I can't stream as much as I'd like to because I need to practice vocals 5 to 7 days a week, 2 to 4 hours a day, because I blew my voice out in 2014. I need to keep it up. I need more practice, more rehearsal, more warm-ups than other people need because I just need it. And Brandon said, why don't you stream that? I said, Brandon, no one wants to watch me do vocal exercises and play the same Trivium songs every single day on Twitch. He's like, I bet you they do. Just try it out. So I went home, started that new rig, and the channel just kind of popped off a little bit from there. But then it would level out. You know, it would have a peak and then a valley. I went on tour, another peak and then a valley. So it's always steady, like chunks of growth. And that's the difficult thing. I think a lot of band people are jumping in and they're having success right at the gate. But the thing is, it's just like being in a band. It's just like getting in a van for the first time and deciding, hey, I'm going to go tour and try to make fans. It was just like that Canadian Dillinger Escape Plan support tour. It's going to have ups and downs. So I just stuck with it. And Brandon taught me, he's like, it's about community. It's about consistency. And you have to genuinely love what you're doing. And I never thought of it as I'm going to do this for a source of income. It was just, I'm going to do this for the people that helped me to play my music for a living and kept it going. When the world shut, that's when the channel truly exploded and the viewership like 5-6x'd because everyone was home at the time. But I knew, I was like, once things start leveling out again, the numbers are going to go back to where they were. And that's fine because I want people to be able to go back and support their families and do the things they love and do their jobs. But as we've seen ebbs and flows, you know, America's pretty much been open the entire time, for better or for worse. And you'll see the ebbs and flows as things shut from around the world. But it's the way I think of the channel is I'm going to be rehearsing and practicing and doing the prep regardless. And if people want to come and hang out and be with some of the greatest people on the planet, come on down. And I really love it. One of the things that Brandon taught me as well, and didn't teach me, but he pointed out, was that I'm one of the few streamers he'd ever seen that recognizes and remembers all the subscribers by name. And I know what kind of games they play or what kind of characters they play when they game or things like that. And it's just, it's knowing the people that allow you to do what you do for a living. And that's the thing that we've always kept with Trivium. Trivium has always been about community, and only being solely supported by our supporters, we get to know them better than everyone. And that's why we kept doing the things. Like when the world was shutting for the first time, when the pandemic first started creeping around our labels, like, you guys should delay your record. You should not release it. You're not going to sell any records. You're not going to sell any CDs because everything's shutting. And we said, we don't care. Like, just get this out. We're like, we don't know how long the world's going to shut. Release this record. So we put out What the Dead Men Say. Obviously had no vinyl sales, no CD sales, but we didn't care. And we kept going. We would safely practice. At first, we're like, all right, well, we should stay away from each other and wear masks. So we'll all stay in separate quarters of our practice room and get ready. Let's put a show together. Did a pay-per-view show, invested all of our money that we had into making Lighter Distant Mirror happen. That was the money that was basically going to float us if touring didn't come back. But like, let's just sink it all into this and see what happens. And our supporters thankfully bought a ton of tickets, ton of merch. That thing went well. We were able to take that money, buy a headquarters, which is the Trivium airplane hangar that we bought, invest into that, and just keep it going. We kept saying, like, we can never stop. And when we weren't able to make records the traditional way, stayed distant a bit, but we knew we need to be together. Like, metal should be created in a room together with the same people. So masks and distance, masks, vaccines, then vaccines and no masks, then vaccines and masks again, and then boosters and good to go. So it's, yeah, you just have to evolve with it. You can't fight against it. I remember when Spotify first started coming around, or digital music first started coming around, a lot of people would try to fight it. They're like, well, you know, this is terrible because CDs, the quality's better and, you know, less money and all this. And yes, we can have the attitude of, I'm going to fight against a thing because it's not as good. But at times when, I can't think of a better metaphor, but when that iceberg is dead in front of you and you're heading towards it, you have to veer and figure out how to get around it or above it. You can't just go through it. You can't hope to go through it. So we always try to like adapt and evolve and do things differently than we've done, and do things differently than we've seen other people do. I don't know why that is. It's not like a rebellious thing. It's a, hey, how do we evolve? And a thing I always say in jiu-jitsu to people that, you know, everyone that does jiu-jitsu is pretty addicted. They're always training when they're hurt. Like my MCL has been slightly torn for a while, but I keep going anyway. It's not fighting through an injury. It's working around an injury. It's stopping the use of that and compensating somewhere else till the other thing gets better. So it's not working through something. It's working around something.
It sounds like you guys have been working very hard. That's for sure.
I'm lucky that all four of us are, as I quote myself, religious practitioners of our instruments.
It's incredible. And the mindset and the timing of everything that you've done seems to be fortuitous and seems to have came at the right time, you know, meeting, you know, starting Twitch when you did, meeting the people that run Twitch, getting this live rig, building this all up, them encouraging you just to practice.
It's crazy. Yeah. The timings have always been, you know, I'll hear stories nowadays of, you know, the stories we hear now. It's like, all right, young people decided to, hey, I'm going to invest in Bitcoin or Ethereum in 2016, 2017. And they see the writing on the wall. They hear the writing on the wall. And I remember the other day I was saying out loud, I was like, man, I wish I had a friend that would have tipped me off about that. But then I realized John and Brandon did. They're like, hey, Twitch, like this thing, you could turn this into something. And now, just like you said, so I don't know if it was, the timing was right in this and how things were going to go, or it just kind of, it altered the timeline. I'm not sure which way it is. And sometimes you just have to take advantage of that. And if it's right, it's right. And yeah, I'm very fortunate. I mean, our band isn't massive, but the fact that I get to play the kind of music that I want to do for a living and have a good time with that. And it's amazing. I mean, I just signed my first book deal, not to do a traditional book, but to actually do a kid's book. So doing a kid's book of all Japanese stories, because I've never seen that exist in the mainstream world. I was like, I want to do something that's my stories, the Japanese folkloric stories done into a children's book. My black metal record is coming out soon that is actually also based off Japanese stories. I said to myself, I've never seen or heard of a Japanese band that taps into the old lore of like the Shinto stories or the Japanese gods and goddesses and monsters. And it's finding these things that don't exist and creating them. Like when I wanted to stream music on Twitch, there was no guide to do it. There were other musicians streaming on Twitch, but they were doing their thing. And that was kind of the set in the way. I was like, I need to figure out how to make my way work here. So it's, to quote myself again, it's organic improvisation on top of that religious practitioner's mindset.
You got to put the work in. It's a hard grind to get anywhere. It's like the podcast. It's one episode at a time, one conversation at a time, one beer at a time. And you got to be consistent.
Absolutely.
What is the next level? What is after Twitch? Is there already something else that's happening that you should be doing that you're not, that you feel like you're procrastinating on to take yourself to that next level of being intimate with people?
I'm going to be keeping this going for forever, hopefully. I absolutely love it. I see no change or no need to change this. I do 5 days a week, two times a day for the last 4 years, essentially. I do 7 days a week when I'm on tour. 7 days a week, 1 to 4 times a day on tour without fail, because I love it. Once I incorporate something into my schedule, I keep it there. It's been really cool collabs I've been able to do thanks to streaming on Twitch. I just did an incredible, like, I was like, I want to do like a 2004 style metalcore song. And I actually paired up with the drummer of One Direction to do it. And he's actually a sick metal drummer. So we did that. Yes. I did a cover of Richard Marx with Richard Marx, making it into a metal song. Doing a song with Deadmau5 coming up soon. Did a song with Mike Shinoda. Just like random things that I wouldn't have been able to do before. So I think since being home, we've been able to stay productive with Trivium and build our hangar and make that exactly what we want to make it. But also being able to do these other interesting, strange things. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. It's creating things out of thin air are some of my favorite things in the world. I'm working on a video game soundtrack finally. It's been my lifelong dream to score a game. One of my jiu-jitsu partners, he was on the original Modern Warfare team. He like helped make Modern Warfare, and he's doing a really cool game, and they decided to sign me up, except it's majority samba and lo-fi samba music. So it's completely different than anything I've ever done. So it's just a whole bunch of stuff.
That's a different challenge. That's fun.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Just creating things that don't make sense out of thin air is one of my favorite things in the world.
I have a 3-year-old that's right there.
You have a 3-year-old too? Okay, awesome. How many kids do you have? 1, 2?
I have 2, but the 3-year-old is home with me today, and we're doing an experiment, and I'm trusting him. He's playing with his trucks. Well, here's those falling in the background of the video of this, but he's going to be quiet most of the time.
That's fine. I mean, you can hear my kids screaming on my black metal record, like on a quiet part. You can hear them playing in the background.
That's amazing. Me and my wife mostly, actually released 2 children's books throughout the pandemic. So,
dang.
They're about a family coping with the pandemic. One of them's called Today We're Staying Home, and the other one's called Hidden Rainbow, when there was that whole rainbow movement of kids drawing rainbows and sticking them in the windows. We made 2 books upon
that.
That's
amazing.
I'm an early childhood educator, and I was basically just like an advisor on the book. My wife, Jessica, did all the work.
That's incredible. Awesome, man. I look forward to checking those out. That's really cool.
The artist is amazing. Jeannie Bond, the illustrator. She did killer work. Today We're Staying Home, we snuck in a little Vox and Hops logo, of course. Let's talk
awesome.
About The Court of the Dragon. In The Court of the Dragon, I apologize. Came out October 8th via Roadrunner Records. It's a killer album. I have Jerry Monk, who's Vox and Hops' metal architect. He curates all of my playlists. He's from Texas. He loves you guys. So he was like, Matt, you gotta listen to this record. So I did. And I really, really enjoyed it. But I've been digesting it for quite some time, and I know what it's like recording and releasing music. I'm curious if there's anything about this release that you wish you could change now that it's out there and it's gone and you can't. If you could go back in time, what would be something that you would change?
No. And I get asked that a lot for our entire discography, and we've taken some pretty crazy chances. Like records 1 through 7 are completely different from each other. The only thing I'd ever go back, the only record I'd ever go change anything on is actually our first record. And the only thing I'd do differently is have a click track. That's the only record we didn't play to a click track. And the tempos are like all the hell over the place. And since it was our first record, we're like, we just got signed. Hell yes, let's go. And I was 16 and all I did was play guitar. That the rhythm guitar playing is too fast to play now. So that's the only thing. I just add a click track. I'm fine with the performances. Just like make it 1 tempo versus 15 tempos per song. But everything else, even the ones that The Crusade and Silence of the Snow are probably 2 of the more polarizing records we've ever done. Because I decided for Crusade, which is our 3rd record, let's do the exact opposite of everything we just did. Ascendancy. People felt like we nailed it. The UK loved it, but no one else really did. And people didn't take us seriously as a metal band. Even though I was like, man, I hear, you know, I'll see naysayers say you guys are a metalcore emo band. But I was like, man, there's death riffs on here. There's Martyr riffs on here. And Martyr, by the way, one of my favorite bands of all time from French Canada. Like Daniel Mungrain taught me so much of what I know about guitar.
He's killing it in Voivod.
Yes. And so, like, yes, it's not as tech as Martyr, but Martyr was something like I took the influence of that and distilled it with, like, Dimmu Borgir, but also distilled it with, like, what was happening in German metalcore and all these different things. And so I said, let's show everyone how metal we are and that we know more about metal than these critics do. So we made it like essentially an 80s thrash record after that. It had no screaming, no double bass, no nothing that we did on the previous record. But I wouldn't even change that. And Silence of the Snow, I blew my voice out, thought I could never sing again. We're like, let's go even pre-thrash roots. Let's show people what influenced thrash. Let's go back to like Dio, Maiden, Priest, Sabbath roots and make a record off of that. So even those, like, I wouldn't change those. I think that every mistake that you ever make is good because it brings you to where you're going to be in the end. It's just like jiu-jitsu. You have to tap and you have to tap off and you have to lose a lot. You have to get trapped a lot. You have to get choked and you have to get things, you have to get caught and you have to lose a lot to get good. You can't only win. You can't only make the correct decisions because you'll never learn anything.
But you must persevere and continue.
Yes.
Because you can't give up.
Yep. Yeah. One of the ethos for me of practice in life is I practice to be, let's say for vocals, for example, I practice to be as good as Bruce Dickinson and Freddie Mercury, Ronnie James Dio and Freddie at the same time as Freddie Mercury, Ronnie James Dio and Bruce Dickinson. I practice to be as good as them knowing it'll never happen. So I know it'll never happen. I'm going to keep working to get that good. So it's, you know, part of it sounds kind of negative, but it's not really, it's that cyclical, perpetual, always working to be the best. If fans ever ask, how do I get better? You guys are my favorite band. I say, strive to be better than your favorite bands. And when we'd go out and play with our favorite bands, like, all right, we need to play better than them. And that's not thinking of it like a nasty competitive way, but in a way to better yourself and to always strive and always push and push and push harder.
I love asking this question. I typically ask this question, but I feel like you've already done it. I always typically ask a band for a record, If you could pick a dream tour, the best tour to put your band in front of a bigger band's audience, but you've already done that. So there's no point asking this question. You know, you just finished the Metal Tour of the Year. You're doing it again. You're going out on tour with Iron Maiden at the end of this year. So there's no point in asking this question, but I will flip the question and ask, if you could choose smaller bands that could really benefit from being on tour with Trivium, what bands would those be?
We try to always bring them too. Thankfully, one of our favorite bands in the world, Fit for an Autopsy, they've built an amazing career on their own, but we were able to bring them on a couple tours. I just always talk about them, and they're on their biggest headlining tour ever right now. They're selling out venues, crushing it. The dudes hit me up. They're like, man, we don't have to be in a van on this tour. This is insane. So I'm so happy for them. And any band that we could ever, bands don't need it, but if we can ever help promote, like, we understand that of our size and that kind of like middle range of bands, every band that we help promote and bring up from the underneath, like all rising ships, like bring everyone up together. It should never be about this is mine only. I'm not going to share. But when I'm doing well on Twitch, it's good for me to bring over as many musicians as possible. And that's what we've been doing. Bring over as many people as possible so that the audience grows and every band can do well. That's why ever since we've been out, when people first saw us, it was always us wearing shirts of our favorite bands, like classics. And then it's us always talking about what bands we love and what bands to listen to. And same thing, like when I knew I was talking with you, I was like telling my chat in the morning, I was like, man, Cryptopsy is like, we grew up with this. Like I still play the Phobophile riff all the time. And like, it's so important to talk about that. Because I see the bands bigger than us that could be securing the future for the rest of all the bands, us and everyone below. And they're not. They're bringing out the same bands that everyone else brings out, the same bands that aren't of the same world that they should be. And it's not, you know, protecting it for future generations of heavy music. And that's the way we try to do it.
But that's a new mindset of the younger generation of musicians and collaboration, as opposed to it's mine, I'm afraid of you. It's let's build this together. High tides raise all ships.
There's the quote. Thank you. I'm having a serious... Well, you understand dad brain, but you are not seeming to have dad brain at all today.
I've had two beers. I'm okay. Yeah.
That's usually when my brain starts working better, too. So I do see what you're doing.
Hey, what's up, Vox and Hopsheads? I just want to take a little moment about Cryptopsy's upcoming tours. That's right. I'm talking about the Scream of Perseverance tour and our headliner dates that coincide with that tour called As Summer Burns. The Scream of Perseverance tour is kicking off at the end of May and runs all the way until the end of June We are supporting the mighty Death to All. We are going all over the United States, and we are hitting some of Canada. So excited to be honoring the legendary music of Death alongside amazing musicians that performed on these albums. Even more stoked to be doing some headliner dates in some cities that I've actually never played in. If you are planning to come to any of these shows, you should definitely grab your tickets by going to voxandhops.com/summer, and you will be able to grab all of your tickets there. That's voxandhops.com/summer. Do it, people. Come hang out with me. Enjoy life, metal, and craft beer in your hometown. Come to a show. We're going to have a great time. Now, enough about all of that. Let's get back to the episode. Extreme metal. I know you're a big fan. You've just mentioned it. You were a guest on Cabal. That was a funny story how that happened. For Bitter Friend, you were on that. You have probably one of the best extreme metal drummers in your band that I've ever toured with, Alex Bend. He was playing with Decrepit Birth when I first met him. We toured Europe together. And he's from Archaic, of course. So talk to me about extreme metal and how you try to sneak it in to Trivium. Is there a place for extreme metal in Trivium? You guys are obviously really into it, but you seem to delve in it, but not really push it into Trivium.
Yeah, for us, it's always like tucked in there. I'm going to look at the discography now as I talk about it. I'm trying to think of like the earliest times that it was ever really there. Actually, from Ember to Inferno, you could see where I started bringing in, because when Trivium first started, we were like a 3-piece thrash metal band. Then it was kind of like a 3-piece death thrash band, like early death. And then I got it melodic death metal. That's when we made our blue demo, started making songs like Requiem and Fugue. And it was the German hardcore scene getting into that while also being super fluent in black metal, liking death metal. Like I've always been really into black metal, into death metal, heavily into melodic death metal. Then you kind of like pepper some metalcore on top. But things like, see, the song Falling to Gray, well, they'll have those very tremolo pick moments, but in E standard. So it doesn't really show off the death metal thing, but it's really been, I feel like death metal has always been a little bit more in our band because it's been a little bit easier to incorporate that than black metal. But you'll hear the chords of black metal kind of peak out a little bit. I think it was later in the career, more so in the Court of the Dragon, that I was able to kind of flex that black metal muscle a little bit more, like the chorus of In the Court of the Dragon. The death metal aspect, I think Shogun, we showed it off the most using those kind of monstrosity style or Morbid Angel, early Morbid Angel style picking, things like that. It's always just been like a healthy balance. We never really think too much like, hey, we need to show this or this genre. The way we make music is we practice tons with all the material that we have already. We might start with a riff or an entire song brought to the band by one of the guitar players, Corey, Paulo, or myself. Bring into the room, and that organic improvisation is when that starts to happen, when we allow anything that we want to play, anything we want to do, just be there. I think that mixture, if you have to pick genres, I'm looking at the titles, if you have to pick it, it's the mixture of metal, like, you know, that kind of like Metallica thrash, like all broad range of metal, extreme metal, melodic death metal probably being the most, then death metal, then black metal, and then little bit of the core stuff like metalcore and hardcore, but I think it's not as much as people really give credit to at all times, but I think those three equal balances end up becoming, you know, the Trivium of Trivium. Just always loved it. I think people are going to be pleasantly surprised with Ibaraki, because when I first wanted to do a black metal project, I understood the mentality of elitism and extreme metal, because yes. I was one of those kids when I was 16.
And black metal is probably the most.
Yes. I was wearing a crazy, like, you know, long sleeve Krizian shirts to school while blasting Cryptopsy in my truck and showing up and thinking that anything with clean vocals sucked. And I understood the mentality, and I was like, and I was like, I don't want anyone to ever, you know, this is my heavy music. What you're thinking is heavy is not heavy. And I'd like show people, you know, Gateways of Annihilation. Or that's when Puritanical first came out by Dimmu, and I was really, really into that record. So when I first started thinking like, hey, I want to make black metal, I was like, I'm going to make it under an alias, not tell anybody it's me, and I'll show everyone how great it is. It was 2010 or 2009 that I finished my first, like, I finished this song, and I was able to make contact with Ishan, because I saw a kid outside In Flames Burger Bar, because I was good buddies with In Flames, took a picture of this 15-year-old kid wearing an Emperor shirt. My friend Darren Toms at Candlelight sent it to Ishan for me and connected with Ishan. And I said, hey, I've been a big fan for you for a long time. Here's a black metal track I wrote. I want to see what you thought. And he's like, yeah, this is, you nailed it. This is like pure second wave black metal. Good job. And that's kind of it. I was like, huh, that's it. But then he released Eremita. I listened to that record, and when I started hearing saxophone solos and clean singing and jazz stuff and all this really bizarre stuff happening, I realized that if black metal, well, for all its faults and for all its positives, was the response to metal being all the same, and it was the rebellion. It was like, hey, we're going to rebel and make something completely different, something new. That was really cool. But then when it gets set in tradition and saying, like, we have to stay this way, and if you go outside of this, you're this, this, or this, it's not black metal, it kind of ends up doing the same thing that it rebelled against. So then when I heard Ishan's approach with Eremita, and I started thinking about the way he did Emperor, every single record was very different. Did things that kind of you weren't supposed to do, or other bands weren't really doing or weren't really into, and didn't fall in line with the things, the tropes of what you're supposed to do or supposed to be as a black metal musician. It reinvented the way I thought of it, and I rewrote everything that was Mritsu at the time, the black metal project, and shifted the music, changed it a lot. It became, when I say post, people kind of picture like shoegaze in their head, but it's not like that at all. But
labels,
it kind of
people
became
love
different.
It makes them feel
yes.
Makes them comfortable.
Yeah, I think it's good to like use like a base reference point and then go from there. As we finished all the music, and we started in 2010,
wow.
And now it's 2022, and we're finally about to release
12 years.
I couldn't figure out what the heck to do for the lyrics. And I remember saying to Ishan one day, I was like, man, I wish I were Nordic so I could write about Thor and Jormungandr. He's like, Matt, that's been done. He's like, and you have it. Tap into your Japanese side. It just all opened in my mind. I wrote the lyrics of the entire record within like 2 or 3 days, wrote it all in the stories of, you know, I just referenced Thor and Jormungandr, the story of that in Japan. Is Susanoo fighting Yamato no Orochi, which is this eight-headed serpent in the sea. And Susanoo is the storm god, essentially the Thor of Japan. And that's already tattooed on my back. And I was like, oh, there's the story. I know this story. So I started writing about that, changed the band name to Ibaraki, and made it all about Japanese stories, which then influenced the idea of, I was doing some stuff for AAPI Month, Asian American Pacific Islander Month, for Twitch, which is really cool because I was like, wow, I've never had Asian peers in metal. Like maybe like one or two people, or like Eddie Van Halen was like one of the few heroes, him and Kirk, like half Asians that I knew, that I looked up to. And I was like, I want to make a book that can like show the Asian stories all to everyone and kind of show everybody a little bit about my culture. And because I've always felt weird being like, I'm half Japanese, 37% Irish, and like a bunch of other mixed stuff. So I never really felt like I fit in somewhere. And then to start seeing like, well, I can show the people the stories of my culture and hopefully influence others to go, wow, that's where Matt's stories come from. I wonder what this person's stories come from. I wonder what this country has to say about these legends or these lessons in life. And it was this really cool thing that it was all from that conversation. I remember sitting on the side of my kid's sandbox when Ishan said that to me on FaceTime. He's like, tap into your Japanese side. And it opened up from there. Now, as we talk about, he and I talk about Ibaraki too, and talk about what he's been up to, it's all exciting. It's really fun stuff.
That is very exciting. And it makes perfect sense that it comes from you, because there's nothing more important when you're creating to have it be a part of yourself than trying to imitate something else. I'll never forget touring. My first tour ever with Cryptopsy was in Mexico, and that we were playing, or we went to a bar afterwards, and there was a black metal band playing from Mexico, and we were very it was like, it's awesome that they're playing black metal, but it'd be so much cooler if they were playing something that belonged to them, mm-hmm. and that they were showcasing
absolutely
their culture.
Yeah.
So this is amazing that you're doing that. What are you imagining for this in the future? Are you going to tour Ibaraki? Is it just a release? What is the stage going to look like? Because typically black metal tends to have a lot of theatrics that go with it.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, we were talking about shows and thinking about shows originally, but because it's essentially a one-man band right now, I mean, mm-hmm. it's me on everything. Ishan actually co-wrote quite a few things. He did all the symphonics, just like he did off the new Trivium record. Like, all the symphony stuff's all Ishan.
Really?
He did all the That's symphony awesome. Stuff and all the different instruments on Ibaraki as well. Alex played all the drums, but it's really just like a one-man kind of thing. I'm not sure. And as we start to talk about the concept of the second one, I think we're going to, because it's, you know, a project that isn't Trivium. Like, Trivium, we've already done all the pivots. We did 7 pivots to land up on 8, 9, and 10 being the summaries of everything that we do. So we're finally consistent. I'm not saying we were inconsistent professionality, but like, we liked to go, where else can we go? I feel like Ibaraki, it can go anywhere. And I think that's the beauty and the fun. And I've been very into like what Wardruna is doing, very into the fact that like you can tap in even further of where the roots of something come from. So there is even that. I've been saying like, I would love to like learn some traditional Japanese instruments and go to that level. So maybe we can even go super old school.
That'd be amazing. Let's talk about the hangar. I'm so damn impressed. At what point did you realize that you needed this in your life, a headquarters? Is it heavily inspired by Metallica HQ? Let's start with those. I have a few more.
Yeah, we started looking around and we started saying, all right, we're, you know, like I say, we're a middle-sized band. And we started looking around like the upper middle. We're like, they don't really have like a thing we know of. You know, Metallica and Foo Fighters, they have a thing, but how come more people don't have a thing? We started getting fed up with paying rent at a place we hated.
Exactly.
We're like, we hate being at this old 60s music store that we're rehearsing at. It's terrible. It burned down once while our stuff was in it.
Oh, shit.
So we started to hate it. And we said, like, let's look around. So I started looking at residential real estate to turn it around. Then I started, I was introduced by a realtor to commercial real estate, and she showed me an airplane hangar that was an Airbnb. And I was like, this is incredible. And the price is a little out there. I mentioned the story later on to my mother-in-law. I was like, yeah, we found this really cool thing. It's just a little bit too expensive. And it's an Airbnb or airplane hangar. She's like, oh, you know who's selling one of those at the same plot is Ashley's cousin. So Ashley's cousin, who also happens to be the owner of a construction / contracting business, owns this hangar he's selling next door to him. So he sold it to us, did all the build outs of everything. We're able to get a really good rate on it. And it's been very inspiring, and it's already paid for itself essentially, like with all the photos and video shoots and now other bands, because there's nothing in Orlando to use that's affordable or in a good area. And it wasn't our plan to have some people can rent out, but now we've got other people talking about they want to shoot videos there or shoot things there, live streams there. We're building out our studio. So when we do Record 11, we'll fully do it in the hangar. So we could take our entire recording budget and just put it into that instead of having to pay a studio. It's great. It's just the idea of investing in ourselves. And I think it's been a lot of fun.
What were some of the biggest challenges getting it to sound good? Because I can only imagine a hangar is boomy and stuff. I saw you guys like built a room up in it.
Yeah, the room up there is perfect. Like, amazing. We didn't have to do much. I think the roof spray is called Isonine, and that just helps with a little bit with sound, a little bit with AC. But I think it's good to have to practice outside of like the perfect conditions sometimes. Like the main floor of the hangar.
No shows tend to.
Exactly. The main floor of the hangar, like, it's too expensive to AC that area. So it's always pretty hot. But that's good. It keeps you used to playing hot shows. It keeps you used to being used to weird acoustics. Also, we don't use cabs for rehearsal rooms. We're finally bringing cabs back to our live show. I don't think we've been using cabs since like 2009. And I think from 2009 is when we started using amp modelers, but now we're back on heads, back on cabs.
The opposite of everyone else. I love that.
Yeah, always the opposite. But now we're going back to heads, but heads with the Captor X's, so that models the cabinet itself to the PA. So we've got a direct out to the PA, but then we're also using cabs on stage for our stage volume, which we got the idea from being on tour with Megadeth and Metallica. They both have cabs that they're not miking. It's purely just for the feel. So we brought that back, and that's been really nice. So it's like the perfect mixture of like old school and new school, which is like what we pride ourselves on being into, like knowing where your roots come from, but also where they need to go.
I typically ask people how they've been filling the void, but we know how you've been doing that of performing live. You got to perform a bit. My question really is, when do you sleep?
It's a good question. Our kid finally, Akira's a really struggled sleeper too. So he only learned, he didn't start sleeping the night till about 13 and a quarter months, but his sister, there we go again. Our daughter, his sister, Mia, was like a great sleeper by 3 months. Okay. So, but if one of the two of your kids isn't a good sleeper, as you know, then you just aren't sleeping well. So we sleep when we can. I recognize I'm a very high anxiety person. And the more things I am doing that I want to do, the better that anxiety is. I don't know if it's band-aided. I don't know if it's quenched. I don't know if it's silenced, muted, what it is.
It's just that your brain is occupied on something else and the anxiety has to hide.
Yeah. So I like to work a lot. Like when we do the stream, it's making sure I practice a ton on my own, do something constructive as well. But I'm also very much so into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and Ashtanga Yoga and Steel Mace and all this stuff. So it's a lot of things that I do. But I make sure it's always things that I want to do. It's never things that don't make sense. And I think by now I know what things don't make sense for me. But it's nice. It's like, there's like three entities of myself. There's like Trivium, which is very established. There's this kind of like me thing that can do like dumb, stupid internet memes where it still feels authentically me and hilarious and strange. And there's Ibaraki, which is going to be incredibly serious. And I feel like having those three partitions, they're already essentially there. And I love the fact that Ishan one day said, he's like, Matt, I think it's really interesting that You can do this very serious Ibaraki project. You can do what you do with Trivium, but then you can also do the silly stuff that you do on online. And he's like, and it all makes sense. He's like, and none of it hurts each other, which I think is really cool. And it was great to hear that from someone like him.
Yeah, because he is the master of seriousness.
Yes. Yes, he is. Yes,
he is. Let's talk about beer collabs. I love them. I've made probably 35 of them in the past year and a half. You've done some stuff with some breweries. I came across a few things before sitting down here. Dig Brew, dropped a Yuzu IPA, which was a Yuzu juice, Citra hops, 5%, for a record release listening party in Birmingham. And then Red Light Brewery in Orlando did a wit beer for you guys for another listening party. Have you guys done any other big beers? Have you released a beer or Trivium in the past?
We've only done the event ones. We've wanted to do a globally or nationally distributed one for a long time. It's just finding a partner that wants to do it with us as well. Because I assume it's tough on both parties, but we've been approached for like a state-based thing or a city-based thing. The only way we do that, if it's state-based, if it's Florida, because I feel like it makes sense, but we really want to do at least full US, full North American, or full world. So any great beer companies out there want to do it. I hit up Urban Chestnut. I was like, hey, if you guys ever want to do a collab beer, I think we've read the right ones for it. I've always felt that doing a... let me make sure I get the style order in line. A Belgian style Japanese. That's one of my favorite beers in the world. Like Ginga Kogen is one of my favorite Japanese beers in the world. And it's a Belgian style Japanese beer. That would be a perfect thing for us to do. So if any of your beer friends or beer contacts are interested, yes, we are absolutely interested. We just want to make sure it's got the right distribution, whether it's all North America or whole world. That's what we want to do.
Very interesting. Maybe you could team up with Unibrew like Megadeth.
Yeah. I love their brewery. I love their stuff. I think they make some of the best Belgian style outside of Belgium. Them and Holland surprisingly make some of the best Belgians outside of Belgium.
Interesting. What would you call that beer?
I mean, we could pull anything cool that sounds Japanese, I think works. We could do something off in the Court of the Dragon, which would work. I can't remember exactly the words that we used at Red Light, but it was in the Court of the Dragon in French is what we did for that one, for that. But yeah, we've done a couple beers with Red Light, which is one of my favorite beer bars in the world. If you're ever down here in Orlando, I'll take you there. It's incredible. It's so cool. The selections are amazing. It's always one of the top rated beer bars in North America, maybe not North America, but at least the States. It's insane. And it's like just a few minutes from my house.
I would love that. Let's wrap up. One last question. Probably doesn't happen to you very often. You got two young twins, three-year-old twins that got you going. You stream twice a day, 5 days a week. If not, you're writing a black metal record. You're jamming. You're building a hangar. You hardly sleep, but every once in a while it happens to everyone. What is your hangover cure?
Yeah, I found that in my later age, like, we went to, and we celebrated our anniversary the other day, and had like two giant glasses of wine and a cocktail, and we were both dragging the next day. Like, man, this is all we can handle nowadays. I mean, I feel like I eat like 5 times a day. I drink like 2 gallons of water a day. So if I'm hungover and that's still going on, it's a problem. Corey would always go to Pedialyte, but he never really is hungover. He's like the champion drinker of our band. Just good, like good, bad for you food. Would be the way, like diner food, Southern comfort food. There's a restaurant we've got here called Seven Bites that does like stoner gourmet, Southern, super heavy stuff. They've been on Diners, Drive-Ins and Dives a lot. Their stuff's insane. Like that kind of food usually is the remedy, that with like more booze. They have a beer mosa there. It's like an orange beer that they mix with champagne, that and a bunch of like baked things and you're good.
Yeah, I love it. Matt, thank you so much for taking the time hanging out with me, talking about your life, music, and craft beer. Absolute honor. So much fun. I really, really appreciate you taking the time. Massive cheers.
Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you all so much for listening right to the end. You know that I love and appreciate that. Man, was this ever so much fun to connect with Matt. What an awesome dude. What an awesome interview. He was just so open and an excellent speaker. What a pleasant conversation I had. I am very, very stoked that he agreed to record this interview on his Twitch channel. He's absolutely killing it on there. So that was very cool of him to allow me to conduct my interview in front of his audience. I hope that you, if you have not yet, go and subscribe to that Twitch channel, because he's on there meticulously many times a week and he's always doing awesome things. Massive cheers to Matt, and I cannot wait to hear more of that Ibaraki project. It sounds awesome. Everything that I've heard so far has been amazing, and I can't wait to hear the rest of the album. Massive, massive cheers to you, Matt. I cannot wait to share a brew with you soon. Now, if you enjoyed this Vox and Hops episode, you should sign up to the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast mailing list. You can do that on my website, voxandhops.com. That's VOXANDHOPS.com. And when you do that, you shall receive 2 emails a month, which will contain all of the details of everything that has happened throughout the past few weeks in the world of the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast. You'll get to see all the details for any episodes which I dropped. You'll get to see if I've been a guest on someone else's podcast. You'll get to see all the reviews that the Vox and Hops album review crew have released. And you'll get to see which bands Jerry Monk, the metal architect himself, has added to the Brutal Awakenings playlist, which is available on both Apple Music and Spotify. You will also get a little glimpse into any projects that I have in the works before I announce them to the public. So there's just so much going on in the world of the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast. I would hate for you to miss a single thing. So please sign up to the mailing list. The Vox and Hops Metal Podcast is brought to you by Sound Talent Media and Evergreen Podcasts. I hope you have a glorious, glorious week. I will be back next week with 1 episode on Tuesday. But until then, remember to enjoy life, metal, and craft beer. Cheers, Vox and Hops heads.
Hey, what's up? This is Blake Weiland. I'm the host of the Tone Mob Podcast. It's a show where I interview guitar people about guitar stuff. We talk about their pedals, their amps, their accessories, their preferences, all that stuff, as well as a healthy dose of whatever comes up. Topics have ranged from aliens to addiction and anywhere in between. Oh yeah, and pizza. We're definitely going to be talking about pizza. So get the show wherever you're listening to this podcast at. Just search The Tone Mob in your search bar and it will pop right up. Come join us. We're having a lot of fun. Thanks for checking it out.